The election is well underway, and although many voters have already turned in their ballots, SDPB is still working to help ensure South Dakotans cast well-informed ballots. Today, we take a look at the ballot measures of the 2020 election. Now, a ballot measure is a piece of proposed legislation to be approved or rejected by eligible voters. This year, South Dakota voters will find three. Marijuana has been on the ballot before. Once again, efforts to legalize medicinal and recreational marijuana in South Dakota lies in the hands of the voters, but in two different ways. If passed, Amendment A would legalize recreational use of marijuana in the state, while initiated Measure 26 focuses on legalizing medical marijuana. Joining us to discuss the pros of initiated Measure 26 was Melissa Mentley. Melissa, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
This has been a long journey for you. This isn't the first time that you've tried to address medical marijuana usage in South Dakota, is it?
No, it's not. This is actually, I always say, third time is the charm. So this is our third attempt to put it on the ballot, and we were successful this cycle, and here we are, 3 weeks away before the general election, and getting ready to vote on it.
Let's talk about, you know, I read the technical definition, but basically tell me what this measure would do and what it doesn't do. What problem is it trying to solve here?
This measure is, to be really honest, it's going to change lives for people in the state of South Dakota. What it addresses is the medical use of marijuana. A lot of people have this misconception that it is medical marijuana is just people smoking, but it is not. What this will do is it will bring in products that are manufactured in our state that are created for patients, as far as like tinctures, lotions, salves, oral film strips that work as well as pain meds, and different options that are out there and available nationwide right now in legal states that South Dakota has no access to.
Give me an idea about how many patients this might help. Like, what do you know about the number of people who have sought this kind of treatment and have been unable to access it in South Dakota? And by that, I mean either, you know, broad estimates that you have or just, you know, people that are reaching out to you and telling you their stories.
Well, that's a great question. So we started a Facebook page back when we started New Approach South Dakota 6 years ago, and that page has organically grown to over 10,000 people. With those 10,000 people came hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people in the state of South Dakota looking for answers, to have questions answered that they had regarding medical use, how it could help them, how it could help their child, what cannabis does for pediatric epilepsy, what it does for cancer patients. So the numbers are incredible. I know of 1,500 patient families in the state that are immediately going to look for access as soon as it's passed, knock on wood, if it passes. And beyond that, we have thousands of other people that have come to us and asked questions and are curious. And my estimate is the first year with the medical marijuana program being in effect, we're going to see probably minimum of 2,000 people in the state that are looking for access.
Tell me a little bit about the dispensaries, and because there's been some confusion about where they can go and how many there can be. What kind of opportunities or regulations are there as far as location of medical marijuana dispensaries?
Medical marijuana dispensaries are able to go into every community based on that community's guidelines or regulations that they pass. So for Sioux Falls, we would expect to see one there. Rapid City, the larger communities would have them. Some of the smaller ones in more highly populated areas, I like to call them the suburbs of the suburbs of the suburbs of South Dakota because, you know, we have the three main communities, but then we have these smaller communities that are outlaying those. And I do expect to see some that will serve a regional area, such as getting out there down into like Chamberlain area and branching across the state each way there. The language that has been written in 26 does not allow counties to cap or to ban. Let me rephrase it. It doesn't allow them to ban having a dispensary in that county. It does allow them to cap how many are in there,
okay.
which ensures access for patients, but doesn't make it so we would have dry counties in the state. That has been a real issue in some communities that have banned legal access and have made patients branch out further than their home community for access. And we did not want to do that. Our patient population is some of the sickest and most catastrophically ill people in the state. And so making it harder for them to get what they're trying to procure as far as what products they'd like, you know, we don't want to make it more difficult on them because some people have the inability to travel.
How common is medical marijuana in other states across the country? What can you tell us about where South Dakota is on this nationwide journey for access to medical marijuana?
Oh, we're so far behind. There are 30 plus states that have legal access to medical. When we get into looking at medical and CBD, there's over 40. And then there are also 11 adult use states.
Talk a little bit about pediatrics, because that's something I think a lot of people want clarity on.
So when we talk about pediatrics, we talk about catastrophically ill children who have catastrophic epilepsy or Dravet syndrome or Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, which are seizure disorders that cause upwards of 1,000 seizures a day and give those children no quality of life. And what we have seen with cannabinoid access is these children can go weeks, sometimes months, without having seizures, and their brain starts to heal and they start to gain cognitive abilities that prior to having access, they had none of those. We have seen children who were having 200 to 300 seizures a day go from having zero, go from not interacting or having any kind of real movement that they are doing themselves to rolling over, crawling. Some are walking. Some are interacting with their families. There's eye contact being made. We have children that are actually speaking for the first time that are using cannabis. And so cannabis in pediatrics is incredibly important. When we talk about healing the young brain, we're looking at children whose brain is constantly firing off a seizure. And that really does halt the development for cognitive abilities, and they miss all of their benchmarks of growth and development as they go through these cycles. And so cannabis has actually started putting little ones on the track to not be as delayed as they would be with seizures every single day. And it's been actually really miraculous, the stories that have come out as states have come on board and become legal, and seeing these children go from, you know, having no quality of life to laughing and running and being part of their families has been pretty amazing.
Fighting the efforts of those pushing Amendment A and initiated Measure 26 is Dr. Benjamin Aker. He's an emergency medicine physician with Avera Medical Group and the president of the South Dakota State Medical Association. He joined us to detail the concerns he has with both Amendment A and IM 26. Thank you for being here today. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about the American Medical Association has weighed in against these two ballot questions. The South Dakota State Medical Association is also speaking out against them. And I do understand that every doctor in the state is going to have their own opinion about certain things. But tell me a little bit about, from the South Dakota State Medical Association standpoint, how do you come to some kind of consensus to say we are as a group for or against something like this? Give us a little behind the scenes with how that works.
Absolutely. So the State Medical Association is comprised of a whole lot of different positions across the state of South Dakota, and we like to represent the 2,000 physicians that we have. But of course, all of those physicians will not always be on having the same opinion on everything. And what they do is they elect their representatives to serve on our policy council, And the policy council contains around 30 to 60, depending on different times, of physicians who are those representatives. And they are the ones who set the policy for the state medical association.
Give me an idea of why you're speaking out against these two ballot questions. What's at stake here?
Well, we're the state medical association, and we are here to protect the health and safety of the patients and all the citizens of the state of South Dakota, because all the citizens are our patients at some point in time, and we're here to try to represent them in the way that we can from a medical standpoint. And when there is something that, like an initiated measure or an amendment or a bill that comes up that is potentially going to harm that health and safety, that is one of the reasons that the State Medical Association speaks up to oppose that. And when we're talking about legalization of marijuana, whether for recreational purposes or so-called medical marijuana, unfortunately, it has the same risk of side effect to the patients and to the rest of the South Dakotans. And we can get into those later. I'm sure you'll ask me about those. But when those risks outweigh the benefits of whatever we're contemplating, then generally speaking, the medical association will be opposed to it.
All right. Let's talk about the fact that when we speak of marijuana these days, we're not just talking about smoking it. We're talking about lotions and other, you know, products that would be available if this legislation were passed, and that are available in other states. Can you speak broadly about side effects or efficacy of those things? Is that too broad of a question? Like, what do we know about the variety of products that are out there, and what works and what doesn't work?
Sure. Firstly, I'd like to distinguish between cannabidiol, CBD oils that are already able to be sold and used in the state of South Dakota. So that's a different issue. But when we're talking about marijuana, we're talking about the plant itself and whatever you can take from that in, and takes the some 400 different chemicals that are in there and puts it into a different form. Most of the time, at least traditionally, it's been in a smoked form, but it also can be modified into an edible format and other ways of ingestion. The risks of that are really the risks that come with taking 400 different chemicals at the same time. We've done lots of research to look into various chemicals in marijuana and their risk, and a lot of those we do know, such as increased risk of cancer and damage to the lungs, such as emphysema and COPD, poor pregnancy outcomes, and also some psychological issues that can happen in people who are have a predisposition to have schizophrenia. They're more likely to have a schizophrenic outbreak or a schizophrenic break when they are using marijuana. And then also the risk to the decrease of your reaction time, your decision-making capacity, that goes down when using marijuana. And we worry that there will be increased injuries, whether that's by motor vehicle injuries or simply other injuries.
The American Medical Association was also talking about accidental ingestion by children and increased calls to poison control. Tell me a little bit about some of the risks of greater access to different kinds of CBD or, I'm sorry, not CBD, cannabis products.
Well, we know even right now, if people do not properly handle their prescriptions that they have, for instance, putting them in a locked medicine cabinet and keeping them knowing where it is at all times, that can get in the hands of other people who are not prescribed, but also into children who look at it like they may think it's candy or something that they can eat and ingest, and then they get sick or die from ingestion of that. So that happens now with the legalized, with any of the drugs that we have for prescriptions or otherwise. Mm-hmm. So why wouldn't we believe that that would happen if more marijuana got into the hands of normal adult people because they are using it recreationally or, again, the so-called medical marijuana? The medical association feels that increases the risk of injury to children because of the increased ability to get marijuana and to use it if these were to pass.
I want to talk about changing perceptions and how you see that. We have well-known public health experts like Dr. Sanjay Gupta from CNN, who famously changed his mind about medical marijuana after looking into people's individual stories. There are many doctors who have changed their minds. There's many voters who have changed their minds, which is what we're seeing with the strength of this ballot question right now. As perceptions are changing and as research is expanding, how are you kind of advising physicians, you know, especially if any of these measures pass, to deal with the ethical balance of, you know, having patients who say, my child's having 300 seizures a day and I'm desperate for this treatment, which I've seen work for other people. And yet they're also balancing, their legal obligations and their ethical obligations. You know, doctors are in a bind here with this.
Well, I would challenge that. I don't think that doctors are in a bind. I think what happens is that people are having difficulty understanding the difference between a drug that is something that we have studied. It's one single chemical that has gone through FDA approval. We know the risks, we know the benefits, we know what dose to use. And the difference between that and something where we're ingesting this plant that has these some 400 chemicals in it, some of which we know are harmful and some of which we just don't even know because we don't have research with it. And when other people are proponents of, again, I'm going to use the term so-called medical marijuana because I don't think it's medical because we have all those chemicals in it. It's not a single drug. What I would remind them is that we already have a drug called dronabinol, which is a medication that can be used for post-chemotherapy nausea and vomiting. And that is derived from the marijuana plant and it's synthesized now. So when we, as researchers, discover a new drug in marijuana, for instance, and we can take that out of marijuana and take all the other harmful chemicals that are in there, remove them, and then use it for things such as nausea and vomiting, or hopefully in the future for things such as seizures and other problems, that is where it becomes a drug. And that is where the, you know, physicians, I believe, would be in support of it.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the physicians who have been supportive of it in national surveys have been oncologists and dealing with end-of-life cancer pain, hematologists also. Are there areas where the research is looking promising?
Well, I mean, I would turn you again to dronabinol in that now we actually have, we can prescribe that for post-chemotherapy nausea and vomiting. I think that's amazing, and I think that's, you know, that some of the proponents of medical marijuana, I think that, you know, that they're vindicated a little bit in saying that, well, that was helping their mother, their father, their patient even, to be able to use marijuana. But the thing that was helping them in that 400 chemicals was the dronabinol. And so now that's been able to be prescribed, and we can say, here's the dose that you should take, here's the frequency that you should take, and if you use it properly, we can have a pretty high certainty that it's not going to give you these bad side effects, and we know how that's going to help you. We just don't have that with the marijuana plant, whether it's used as medical marijuana or recreational.
I want you to say more about these 400 chemicals. Are we talking about, you know, if you grow the plant and in smoke it in a recreational format? Are we talking about, you know, a tincture that's been developed that I would get at a medical marijuana dispensary? You know, explain more about the chemicals that you're talking about.
Absolutely. So in the marijuana plant, when you smoke it, that's where you get 400 chemicals. So now if you were, again, we need to separate the Amendment A, which is recreational marijuana. So that's, we kind of talked about that. And then the IM-26, which is the, again, the so-called medical marijuana. So what that would allow you to do as a patient is to go to a healthcare provider and be certified that you have one of a number of different conditions that's in that initiated measure. And if you get that certification, it basically gives you a card that gives you a license to go ahead and purchase marijuana. So then you can, and whatever, you know, route that they have available there, if you're using under, I believe it's, or if you have one ounce or less on your person at a time, then it's legal for you to use that by whatever route that you desire. The prescriber, the physician or other healthcare person that you saw only gave you the license to get this, did not say this is how much you should use, didn't say this is the route that you should take it, whether you should eat it or smoke it. And so then you're getting those chemicals in you, even by going to a dispensary.
Okay. But your physician would, in theory, recommend what to do at the dispensary.
I would hope so. I don't know if that would happen. There's nothing in the initiated measure that requires that. Mm.
So the doctor would give you basically a recommendation to go to the dispensary, and then at the dispensary you would. So we're kind of parsing exactly how this would work.
Sure.
and how this wouldn't work. Are you supportive? Because I think the American Medical Association has been supportive of a research expansion act to find out more about the medical applications or the healthcare applications of cannabis. Is that something that the State Medical Association is also supportive of? Do we need to know more?
Is supportive of research. Absolutely, we do need to know more, and we support research into marijuana and the components. All these components of it. What is helpful? What is harmful? And how can we separate the two?
A large grassroots effort to collect enough signatures to get Constitutional Amendment A on the November ballot was successful. And now individuals and groups like South Dakotans for Better Marijuana Laws are campaigning for yes votes to make the possession and use of recreational marijuana legal in the state. Supporters for Amendment A have been working side by side with those in favor of initiated Measure 26. Remember, that's the one that will allow for medicinal marijuana if passed. Supporters of Amendment A include former South Dakota U.S. Attorney Brendan Johnson and former U.S. Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle. Dre Samuelson is the campaign director for South Dakotans for Better Marijuana Laws. He joined us to discuss the pro side of Amendment A.
Welcome to the program, Dre. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Laurie, and thanks so much for the opportunity to explain this to South Dakota voters. We really appreciate it.
Tell me a little bit about the momentum that you see for this issue in 2020. It's not the first time that we've been talking about recreational or medical marijuana in the state. This year, there are a lot of voices that are making this conversation sound a little different. What's going on from your point of view?
Well, attitudes about marijuana reform have changed dramatically in the last several years. As you probably know, in 2010, there was a medical initiative on the ballot, and I think it was defeated, as I recall, substantially, maybe about 2-1. But attitudes, just like with gay marriage, changed quickly on some of these cultural issues, and certainly changed quickly in terms of marijuana reform. Nationally, there is a huge majority that favor marijuana legalization. I think it's 65 or 70%. But in South Dakota, our opponent's own poll shows that Amendment A is favored by 62%, and it's opposed only by 32%. So we have almost a 2-1 lead in terms of support in South Dakota for marijuana legalization reform. And I think people are starting to realize that it's coming, and South Dakota would be smart to get ahead of the parade rather than trailing behind it.
I want to talk a little bit about some of those voices who are speaking out against this in opposition and some people who have come forward and are speaking for it. So clearly Governor Kristi Noem created a video urging people to vote against this. So we heard from the South Dakota Medical Association, their board voted to vote against this. Then we also have people, like we mentioned at the beginning, Tom Daschle and Brendan Johnson, urging people to vote for it. And I think your friend and my friend, Dr. Rick Holm, who died earlier this year, before he died, he recorded some videos supporting legalization. And he he had a clear understanding of what some of the challenges would be, which he articulates, you know, as he talks about why he thinks this is a good legalization mm-hmm. is a good mm-hmm. direction to go. He said, but here yep. are the things you're going to have to watch for. But overall, this is what I think should happen. Tell me a little bit about someone who is a physician like Dr. Holm, who worked in providing science-based information for the people of South Dakota for a career. Why was it so important before he died to record that message so people would know how he thought about this issue? What can you tell us about that?
Well, so I talked to Rick. Rick had endorsed it in emails to me, both Amendment A and Measure 26, a few months before he died, and he was hoping to be active in the campaign, and we were certainly hoping that he would be. I mean, the truth is that the South Dakota Medical Association doesn't speak for all physicians, and it certainly didn't speak for Rick. Rick, as you may know, was a former president of the South Dakota Medical Association. He was inducted into the South Dakota Hall of Fame. He was the Prairie Doc, star Prairie Doc, for many years on South Dakota Public TV. And when he gave an interview to the Brookings Daily Register just a few weeks before he died, he felt so strongly about this issue. He wasn't asked about it. He brought it up to the reporter, and if you read the story, which is online, he makes an impassioned plea for people to vote for marijuana legalization reform. My guess is that Rick didn't always favor this. I think he said that he didn't, but I'm pretty sure that he didn't. But like many South Dakotans, he, you know, was evidence-based. He saw that that it actually helps people medicinally. But also, prohibition simply doesn't work. And we now have 11 states that have passed legalization in this country for adult use. And the support for legalization in those 11 states is overwhelming. A polling company called YouGov polled over 30,000 people. And in every one of those states that it polled, the support in those states that with the people that live with this, they know what's true and what's not true. The people that live with it support it by 2.5 to 1 in the lowest number, but in Colorado, which has had it the longest, favors it, supports it by 4.5 to 1. So all the scare stories that our opponents are more than happy to put on TV, send around in mail, frankly, simply aren't true unless you don't believe this the polling. Because these people know what the truth is, and if it was the terrible effect, the horrific effect that our opponents say, people wouldn't support it. In fact, they'd be trying to repeal it. But the truth is, in no state that has passed either medicinal or adult use marijuana has there been even an effort to repeal either of these two marijuana reform issues. And I don't expect that it will happen, because people, once they see what happens as opposed to hear what other people tell them to believe, they find out that it's actually a very good thing for a number of reasons, which I'd be more than happy to discuss.
We'll get to that in just a minute, but I also want to deal with some of the opposition and some of the things that people sure. are saying. So I think the opposition will uh-huh. respond to what you just said by saying, you know, people get addicted to the financial benefit of some of these things. It becomes normalized in their society. And what they're saying is, like, let's not get to the point where things that are addictive and unhealthy are normalized, because there is no going back. What would your response be to people who would argue about that that normalization of behavior and an expectation of revenue?
Well, I think government constantly needs revenue. Our schools need revenue. And as you no doubt know, 50% of the money that will be generated by Amendment A will go to public schools. And I don't think it's a matter of addiction. It's a matter that they need money. And 50% of the money that is generated from Amendment A will go to the state's general fund, which can go to fix bridges and roads or whatever other good public purpose that the state legislature and the governor decides to support. I'm not worried about government getting addicted to money. Government and schools need money, and this is a source of money that right now, frankly, Glory, is going to, you know, illicit crimes, drug cartels, and it doesn't have a public purpose. It not only is it not going to the public, it's going to organized crime, and that is not in our interest at all. And I wish that our opponents recognize this, but they don't seem to.
Marijuana isn't all that's on the 2020 ballot. If passed, Amendment B on South Dakota's general election ballot would change the state's constitution to allow for sports betting in the city of Deadwood. We were joined by Speaker of the House, Stephen Haugard of Sioux Falls. Haugard represents District 10 and provides primary opposition to Amendment B on the ballot.
Let's talk about what you see this constitutional amendment would do and why you're opposed to it.
Well, you know, we have in our Constitution, historically, the provision that the legislature shall not authorize any game of chance, lottery, or gift enterprise under any pretense or for any purpose. And those words were in our Constitution. The founders of the state, the territory, clearly wanted to warn us. And then about 30-some years ago, we thought we were wiser. We added words to allow gambling that's owned and operated by the state. And somehow we thought state-sponsored gambling would be safer. Well, it simply isn't. You know, the sad part of it is we're the second most gambling-addicted state in the nation as far as the revenue source for our state and local government. And this would just be one more problem that we'd add to the mix. And so we're just trying to be responsible. I think that, you know, if the average citizen was able to sit down and review the information that's available as far as the impact of gambling on individuals and families, I think most people would say, no, that's not something we need. And that's why the Constitution was drawn the way it was back in the 1800s.
Let's talk about two things and sort of separate them out. And one is the impact on individuals, which we'll get, and families and communities, which we'll get to in a moment. But what you just said about gambling addicted for revenue, let's talk about from a statewide or community-wide standpoint, this the seeking of revenue from these kinds of sources, because clearly, you know, I can go to a casino and play video lottery in Sioux Falls if I want to, and I can take a trip out to Deadwood and play craps or, you know, roulette. Is this one, you know, why is this different than any of those sort of things that we've already allowed in the state? Why is sports betting, is it different?
Well, you know, I do think it's significantly different. It's interesting that some people are doing this already, even though it's illegal, but they're still doing it. And I saw in an article recently that Keystone finds that about 25% of the people coming in for chronic gambling problems are addicted to sports betting specifically, and pretty much only. And I think what really adds to this mix is the fact that we are a society that's really obsessed with sports in so many ways. Now, COVID-19 has modified that a bit, and maybe that's a good thing to give us a break a little bit from being so consumed by sports. But the fact is that that's a part of life for young people that's pretty attractive, and there's nothing wrong with being involved in sports and enjoying the competition and striving to succeed and improve and all that sort of thing. But if you throw that into the mix, that now we're going to add the element of gambling to it, then that's just one more of those things that a young person doesn't need to have as part of his selection of choices, that they should be focused on doing the right things as opposed to us tempting them with this vice. And that's what the founders of the state and the nation all recognized. Gambling was always a vice, just like prostitution, just like addictions of all sorts. They recognize that if you want to have a strong moral climate, then you will exclude some of these things from the palette of options. And so that's what why this is different. You know, it's video lottery, scratch tickets, all those things. are bad in and of themselves. This is just one more element, and this one really appeals more to a whole segment of the population that's already really involved in a what should be an otherwise productive, beneficial thing, which is sports.
Do you think that there is an inclination in South Dakota and maybe around the nation, I don't know, but specifically talking about South Dakota, to seek revenue sources from activities like gambling that impact in a lot of voters' mind only a small portion of the population? When we're looking for more money for public services or for roads or for schools, do we have a tendency to reach out to some of the things that might be considered traditional vices for revenue sources?
Well, sadly, that's a selling point that's used, but that never takes into consideration the balancing impact on social services and corrections. You know, if we would do a good analysis of this, we would find that we're losing money on video lottery, because the damage that you do to families and individuals is incredible. And even a quick analysis, if you just grab national statistics, you find that half of the revenue that we gain is lost in those areas. And if you plumb that a little deeper, you'd find that actually it's having a net loss. And the fact is that how many people does it take to suicide that you can say this is still the cost-benefit analysis is still in the favor of doing it? So if you've got something that leads people down a path that devastating, why in the world would we consider that as a valid source of revenue? And why in the world would we choose to prey on the most vulnerable in that particular circumstance? You know, we've got lots of areas. The Americans with Disabilities Act, it's intended to alleviate the additional stress and strain and challenges that are placed upon some people that not their own choosing. Now, in this situation, it's barely different. This is a choice that people make, but it's like any other addiction. Once you've chosen poorly and you've walked down that path, it's really a point of no return unless you get some professional help and are able to walk yourself out of that. Also, it's interesting to note that many of the people coming in for gambling addiction treatment, they say that typically the person coming in for gambling addiction is somewhere around $250,000 in debt. And, you know, the first year or so after gambling was legalized in South Dakota via lottery, I had a client come into the office one day to talk about bankruptcy. And he said he had no interest in gambling until all of a sudden he was in one of those places one night and he was waiting for somebody. They didn't get there right away, so he threw a few dollars into the machine. And he said he won. Within a short period of time, he won $1,000. And then he kept playing, and apparently they changed their plans for the evening. He kept playing, and he won another $1,000 within about an hour. And a year later, he was down $72,000 and looking at bankruptcy. So that's the temptation that exists with this. And whether it's video lottery or sports betting, I think they have the same features of pushing people in the direction of an addiction. And the number of people, it's estimated the number of people that support your average corner casino is somewhere around 12 people. And they will be there. You can see the same cars and the same people in those places. And that it's just unconscionable that we as a state would prey upon people that are in that situation.
We have, over the past, oh, I don't know, you know, 2 years, Speaker Haugerud covered almost relentlessly sometimes technology addiction and, you know, social media and how data collection and capturing of the attention, how if you're not paying for the product, you are the product. And we've talked so much about that kind of addiction and the efforts that corporations will go through to, once you, you know, pick up your phone, to get your eyeballs to stay on their platform for as long as possible. In your experience, are there ways that this industry does similar things? Is it passive, where people sort of seek it out and come into the, you know, come into the sports betting venue, go to Deadwood and do this, you know, take part in this activity and then leave? Or are there things that are sort of cooked into the business model to promote return customers, to promote what you would say is addictive behavior?
Well, it's very well developed in early on with video lottery, and including this sports betting, the way they design the scratch tickets, even. It's all designed to draw people in. Some things, like video lottery, is designed in such a way that they have the noises and the rapid movement of the images and the colors. Those are designed to release endorphins in the brain as cocaine. So you're using this medical approach, psychological approach to individuals to try to get them addicted to this behavior so that you increase your revenues. And it was especially appalling in the past 6 months or so, whenever we had I forget which meeting it was, maybe State Affairs, there was a discussion about this sort of thing. And our own employees at the state level talked about how they can manipulate the machines to get anywhere from an 80 to a 92% payout on these machines. So they can just adjust the video lottery machines to pay out whatever they choose. And so we can increase our revenues at will. And with this, it's going to be a little different, but it's still appealing to the same sorts of things, the excitement of a game. And like I say, with a overwhelming interest in sports, you've already got that hook for people to come into this and then to prey upon them. And it's just simply unconscionable from my perspective. And the state, if they want to raise revenue, then do it in a broad-based, logical way instead of just plugging into a very specific, vulnerable source. We should say, if we need more money for education or we need more money for healthcare or whatever it is, then tax us equally. But this is just simply highly inappropriate, and it certainly doesn't reflect well on our students. So many times it's said that we're dependent on gambling to make sure teachers are paid adequately. Well, I don't think there's a teacher in the state that would raise their hands and say, yes, I want to continue with gambling, even though I know people suicide over it. I don't care. I want to make sure the revenues are there so I get paid. There isn't a teacher that would say that. And for us to say that we're going to choose that as a revenue source is, again, just unconscionable.
Now we hear from Caleb Arsenault, CEO of Live Hospitality and president of the Deadwood Gaming Association. He is a proponent of Amendment B.
Caleb, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
For clarity, let's talk about what exactly this amendment would do. This is destination gambling in Deadwood, or is it somehow spread statewide? Help us understand exactly what we're voting on here, and then we'll talk about why.
Certainly. So, as you know, the laws and the ability for Deadwood to have gaming resides in our state constitution. So the specific games that are allowed to happen in Deadwood are outlined in the Constitution. So in order to add any sort of game or game type, the Constitution, we've got to open that back up and bring it to a vote of the people. So the legislature last year is allowing this, actually put this amendment on the ballot. So this effort will really truly be a two-step process. So the first process is to just change the Constitution that adds the language for sports wagering to be allowed in Deadwood. The second step to this process would happen in the legislative session of 2021, and that's when all of the rules whereby sports wagering would be conducted within the city limits of Deadwood would be defined. So the first step is simply allowing sports wagering in the city of Deadwood.
All right. Opposition for this coming from two different areas. One is really dealing with concerns about addiction and gambling, and the other is concerned about why just Deadwood, why not statewide. So let's talk a little bit about why just Deadwood. Why is this a Deadwood amendment? Speak to that a little bit, if you would, please.
Sure. So when we brought forth this amendment, obviously Deadwood is the only commercial gaming jurisdiction that is approved in the state of South Dakota. So that's why it's only Deadwood. Now, there are a couple of different approaches or thought processes to this. It could be, again, only within the city limits of Deadwood, physically within a brick-and-mortar building, or have transactions run through the city of Deadwood and actually geofence the state and allow sports wagering through a mobile app. As the operators in Deadwood are open to either approach, it ultimately will be up to the state legislature to decide how they want sports wagering to look within the state of South Dakota. So I guess the argument, you know, that it's Deadwood only, the only reason is because it's the only jurisdiction allowed to have gaming.
Talk a little bit about the benefits of this, you know, from a taxation standpoint or a revenue standpoint, and then really from a competitive standpoint for this community as we look at, you know, people from other states visiting Deadwood and where else can they go for sports betting? I know it's allowed in Iowa, for example. So tell me a little bit first about, you know, the advantages from a competitive standpoint for the city of Deadwood and the gaming industry.
Well, the gaming industry is ultra competitive. As you know, the proliferation of gaming across the country is gaming is no longer special. It's in everybody's backyard. So in order for us to maintain our destination gaming appeal and to be competitive with our surrounding states who have either already authorized sports wagering or they are in the process of having that done, is very important. It levels the playing field. It creates it allows Deadwood to remain competitive throughout the gaming markets in the region. So, from a competitive standpoint, it's a very important component to the overall gaming product. Now, from a revenue standpoint, there's lots of opinions out there in terms of how much revenue this potentially would earn for Deadwood operators and for the state of South Dakota. It's my opinion that it's not going to be a massive revenue generator, but what it will do, it will attract people to the city of Deadwood where we can, sell them a meal. They'll have a drink, they'll stay in a hotel room. So it's all part of that integrated destination gaming experience. So, from a competitive standpoint, it's really important that we have this tool in the toolbox. It's just adding another game type to an already established gaming jurisdiction.
Can you speak to the concerns over addiction or the morality concerns that some opponents to this legislation have?
Sure. The reality is, in the world that we live in, there is addiction. As a gaming market, we don't deny that. We understand that there's addiction with all kinds of different activities, in life. So gaming is one of them. It's a very, very small percentage. The morality argument is truly one that is, it tugs on your heartstrings. And we may know people that have struggled with any sort of addiction. At the end of the day, someone with an addictive personality is going to gravitate towards activities that may be harmful to them if they can't control it. So whether that be gaming, whether that be drinking, whether that be eating, I understand the argument. I don't deny the argument, but I think it's such a small percentage, and you know we truly participate in those programs to help anyone who's you know struggling with any sort of gaming addiction. And of course, if you can't handle it and it's not entertainment for you, you know, as an industry, we discourage you to play. Don't play. It should truly be an entertainment effort.
Let's talk about the entertainment impact for a moment. I've never done this before. Explain to me why it's fun. Why are people drawn to it? What's the draw?
Sure. You know, it's akin to playing a video game or to playing, you know, any sort of competitive game. So when you have a little bit riding on it in terms of a wager, it makes it all that more exciting. So, you know, it's that excitement of the win, and it's the excitement of the social interactions that you have within these gaming destinations. So it really is an entertainment effort that's so important and critical to our industry.
Will it change the face of Deadwood Kings? Does it look differently than, I mean, is it a separate room? Like, what am I going to see if this passes the next time I come visit Deadwood?
You know, I think you will have some gaming operators that are going to look to add, you know, sportsbook rooms where, you know, rooms with large screens and very comfortable chairs. Others, you know, may just allow you to do it from your mobile phone while you're on the slot floor or at a gaming table. So I think it can look several different ways. Again, much of that will probably be guided through the legislature in terms of how the rules are developed.
Sure. What all can you bet on? Is this something that you have done in other states where it was legal to sort of check out? Like, what's up for grabs?
Sure. Sports wagering, you know.
Caleb, you just realized, like, I have no idea what sports betting is, so I have to explain it. I'm like, football, the Tour de France, like, what can, how far does this extend?
It's an appropriate question, especially again if you're not familiar with it. So, you know, generally you're looking at the major national big time sports. So you're looking at things like the NFL and the NBA and MLB. That all of these different, you know, sports really attract the core of that sports wagering crowd. Now, there are other sports that you can bet on as well. It's going to be up to the operators and, again, the legislature on how we define that. Now, we would highly discourage any sort of sports wagering on you know, high school sports, for instance. You know, we certainly don't want to get into that realm. So we would really focus on these major sports like the National Football League and Major League Baseball and the National Basketball Association.
But voters are opening the door for whatever, and the legislature decides the
That's
parameters.
Correct. So,
okay.
Correct. The parameters will be determined through an effort the legislature will undertake in 2021. So the first step in the amendment that is on the ballot just allows Deadwood to have sports wagering. What that sports wagering looks like, again, will be determined in another effort the legislature will take up.
All right. So how many locations in Deadwood then can handle sports wagering? Is there a limitation to that, or is that door open as well for the legislature to decide?
Yeah, as long as you're a licensed gaming operator in Deadwood, you'll have the ability and the choice to participate in sports wagering.
All right. How has the community handled the pandemic and the change in visitor numbers? If you just, before we let you go in the last minute, anything you want to say about whether those visitors are coming back or not during the pandemic?
You know, we have seen visitation, and I think we've experienced this across the entire state of South Dakota, just based on Governor Noem and her leadership that she's provided and keeping our state open and having us kind of be accountable for our own actions and act responsibly. So we've actually seen, you know, I would consider strong visitation during this pandemic. However, it pales to compare to any sort of numbers from last year. Obviously, the tourism and visitor industry relies on people being mobile and traveling. So when surrounding states and across the country, those things are affected, it certainly affects us here in the state. So I would say our industry has survived. And that's probably the best way I can describe it.
Three ballot questions. Three chances to have your voice heard on issues that will change the landscape of South Dakota. Three questions that have the potential of changing people's lives in various ways. If you want to see what your ballot looks like before you head to the polls, if you need to find out where your polling place is, go to the South Dakota Secretary of State's website, sdsos.gov. The polls open at 7 a.m. local time on November 3rd. They close at 7 p.m. local time. At South Dakota Public Broadcasting, we want you to feel confident about what you are voting for or against. In a democracy, you might not always get your way at the polls, but at least you know you showed up, you engaged, you voted.